Chapter 10. Hevea. New screens lined the corridors leading from the passenger bays. Kicking his heels at Lung Crow Customs, Hevea had plenty of time to see 20 different pundits making hay over the flight of the Vulture God. Some of the talking heads claimed the ship's captain was responsible, but the prevailing opinion was that parties unknown had hijacked the Vulture God and vanished it away. There were several recordings that certainly seemed to show an architected wreck clutched in the vulture's claws. And there was some panic, but there was also denial. Nobody wanted to admit what everyone was thinking. So, a fragile calm prevailed at Lung Crow. No screaming exodus yet. In fact, now the planet was under hegemony rule, maybe prices for a berth to Hwei Kavor would be climbing. Public opinion might sway towards the Essiel, here and elsewhere, when this news spread. All the more reason to find the truth about the wreck. At last Hevea was let through, and he dusted off his credentials as media-type opinionator, under which guise the office supplied a handful of articles a month below his byline. Later that same day, having pulled some local strings, he met with his wisdom, the bearer Sathiel. The man was urbane, grandfatherly, and opulently dressed, surrounded by worshipful followers. He clasped Hevea's bony arm warmly, in the colonial fashion, as they ordered a cup of the caffeinado that humans drank in the hegemony. It tasted like the best parts of coffee, lemon, and almonds. Hevea gave the man his attentive smile and decided he didn't trust Sathiel an inch, but then the whole cult business gave him the creeps. To his mind, inventing a religion venerating extraterrestrial barnacles was a ludicrous response to meeting an alien species. Except, he admitted, it did seem to provide a framework for human-Essiel interactions. "You've been very vocal about the Amaru rumours, your wisdom," he commented diplomatically, channeling his persona of highbrow media-type reporter. They were in a small eatery, and most patrons were wearing cult heraldry, from a simple badge to full-on robes like Sathiel. Hevea's long-sleeved charcoal tunic, trousers and slip-ons were standard kit for someone out of the richer settled colonies, but in this mishmash place, he stood out amongst both the spacers and hegemonic types. Sathiel lifted his beaker. "Caffeinado," he breathed, as though the drink was rare and precious. "Serendipitous child of humans, trying to adapt coffee to the soil of an alien world. Now one of the most widely partaken of beverages known, a major import into the colonies, as doubtless you're aware. And Warcast and Breedercast Castigar can't get enough of it, which is an unlooked-for benefit. Goes to show what can arise when humanity travels to the stars and welcomes the alien with open hands." Hevea tried his smile again and made notes on his slate. "Well, your wisdom, you'll understand that I'm not really here as a potential convert." The cultist nodded understandingly. "My point, Menia Mundi, is that there are those, even here, who don't drink caffeinado because of what it represents, especially here. There are those who would do everything in their power to throw up hard barriers between humanity and its neighbours, even if they have to murder their own to do it." Hevea blinked, nodded, noted. The whole act. "Alleged proof that the architects have returned has been taken from us by unknown persons for unknown reasons. But are you making specific accusations here, Your Wisdom. Sathiel's pleasant smile broadened, and he looked down into the dark liquid before sipping.
I'd risk giving you, a media typist from the inner colonies, something you cannot use, your audience being less pro-alien than some.
My audience is cosmopolitan, Hervea assured him. I mean, I'm no fool. I can see this could be controversial. If we hinted that humans tried to hide evidence of architects for selfish reasons, no doubt we'd get lots of angry responses. But that won't be the majority. I cater to an open-minded base.
Well then, let me be frank. There would be nothing more fatal to the nativist pro-human bloc than proof that the architects have returned. Not only because the divine Essiel have within their power the ability to protect entire worlds from their depredations, but simply because when the architects were a present threat, that was when humanity existed hand in hand with our neighbours. Right now, there are those in power who would rather push them all away. How would that be perceived if there was a new architect war on the horizon?
Sathiel fixed Hervea with a gaze that abruptly had all the grandfather sucked out of it, nothing but steel remaining.
My point, Menia Mundi, is just that. And if you do pass this shocking news onto your audience, you'd be acting in their interests. I appreciate that people within the colonies find all this, he picked at his richly embroidered sleeve, unsettling. Our ritual relationship to the divine Essiel looks like idolatry, perhaps even brainwashing. But I'll let you into a secret, Menia. I'm not religious, not in the way you probably believe. However, the Essiel have the power to accomplish things that, try as we might, humanity cannot replicate. Humanity cannot proof our worlds against the architects using originator regalia. We might happen upon a planet with originator ruins, allowing us to keep the monsters away from only that world. But the hegemony can ward their worlds at will. And if the architects come back, as I believe they have, if the architects keep coming back, what is best for humanity? To ignore the rest of the galaxy and sing stories of our greatness until our last world is just some monstrous sculpture commemorating our end? Or should we accept that we are not self-sufficient and take the help offered at what is a very reasonable price?
Hervea recorded it all, thanked Sathiel profusely, and made his retreat. The caffinado had been very good, he agreed. Hard not to develop a taste for it. Out of the cultist's presence, even he found himself a little shaken. Not a madman, Sathiel, but a persuasive one. It would be profoundly unfortunate should he turn out to be right. Like most colonials, Hervea had no wish to be ruled by alien overlords, but better than dying. After that, it was time to find the vulture god's disinherited crew. When he set out, he'd assumed the whole architect business was a hoax and the vulture crew was at the heart of it. Now, with two of them dead and their ship taken, he wasn't sure what to think. Hervea's contacts eventually tracked them to a maintenance bay by the freight docks. It was a cavernous space, with the stripped shells of two shuttles hanging overhead like whale carcasses. A Hanna Lambra Envoy-class craft sat below these on uneven legs, as half a dozen crab-like aliens and 8 station engineers tried to scavenge sufficient parts to fix her gravitic drive. At the back of the bay, sitting on dented crates, were 3 of the Vulture God's survivors. The broad man was their captain, Rostand. The Hanalambra was the factor, and the skinny youngster was their pilot, Telemier the Int. It set Hervea's teeth on edge to think of such a valuable asset rusting at the fringes of colonial space rather than serving Hugh. Rostand glowered up at him as he arrived.
Are you Piltchern?
From the man's expression, this Piltchern was going to have a bad day when he did turn up. For a moment, Hervea considered saying yes and just winging it, but there were too many unknowns.
Captain Rostand, I'd like a moment of your time. You and every other fucker, Rostand growled.
He was well on the way to drunkenness, Hervea decided, red eyes and a reddening face. Though there was likely grief involved for his lost crew.
I'm not Rag, Hervea replied, which he hoped was still spacer slang for newsmongers.
He decided to ditch his media-type persona, as the crew hadn't given any interviews so far. He pulled out his Hugh Intervention Board ID, the real one, and triggered its authenticator with his thumb. The little square of plastic confirmed his biometrics and bona fides. Rostand stared belligerently at it, then shrugged.
You're out of your jurisdiction, or haven't you been keeping up with current affairs around here?
Spacers were notoriously prickly about Hugh interference, mostly because they were usually doing something illegal. Hervea hooked over an empty box and sat down, smiling.
Captain, I've no official power here, no backup, just a man investigating. You can imagine what.
Word gets to Mordant House quickly these days, said Telemier, not looking at Hervea.
He'd pulled into himself when the ID came out, and Hervea could understand that. Under other circumstances, the man would be the focus of any Mordant operation here.
We heard you brought something in, Hervea said frankly. Then I arrived to find it's been taken from you.
Along with a lot else, Rostand spat. What do you want from us, many a spook? Confirmation that we've found what they say we found? Yes. Verification that any proof disappeared with my damn ship? Yes again. So, there we have it. That's all there is. See, right?
You're colonial citizens, you two.
Hervea looked to Rostand and the Int, ignoring the Hanny for now.
Doesn't mean we do what you say, rejoined the truculent Rostand. Especially not here.
I'm just hoping you have some loyalty to the Council of Human Interests. Being human, Hervea went on patiently. I'm not trying to be nativist, just concerned. If what you found really...
Telemier broke in.
It did happen, and it was recent. I expect you've seen the Amaru's departure logs. Something pulled her off course into the deep void and did that to her.
Hervea tried to meet the man's gaze, but the Int's eyes just kept sliding away, as though fixed on a distant horizon. Standard for intermediaries, though. You couldn't see what they saw without developing the abyssal gaze.
Meneer Telemier, would you be willing to...
No.
I haven't...
No, I will not come and answer your questions about what I might have sensed or not sensed, felt or not felt, in unspace or real space or in the reaches of my imagination,
Telemier told him flatly. I don't do government work anymore. I've served. I've earned the right to be left alone.
Hervea hadn't quite believed the file on Idris Telemier. Crossed wires, surely. Couldn't be the same man. Not enough years on the face for a start.
Must be some escapee from a leash contract, so technically still the property of the state.
Except Purveyor could look into those two young features and see the extra decades lurking beneath the surface like a rot.
I can promise you I'm not going back,
Tolemier said, and Hevea prepared to push the matter. He only caught the iron behind the words in retrospect as Tolemier burst out again,
I'm not going back!
He stood so suddenly that he kicked over his crate, fists balled abruptly. The int was the least imposing physical specimen Hevea had ever seen, a true child of the polyaspora. But the air about him seemed to flex, and one of the gutted shuttles above creaked warningly. A coincidence. It had to be just coincidence. But Tolemier was one of the oldest ints out there, junior only to Saint Xavienne herself. Who knew what they might become? In time. Hevea smiled at him, which was hard, but he was practiced.
Understood, he said easily. I'll leave you with my details, in case you recall something and want to pass it on. Anything will help. This isn't about you. It's about saving lives. Anything.
He trailed off. A woman had joined them. Hevea put a great deal of effort into maintaining his mild, friendly expression. She was Partheni. He noted the badges on her regulation grey overcoat, the service and loss tattoo beneath her eye. But he'd have known her without those signs. Soldiers of the Parthenon all had a certain look to them, literally. Beautiful and deadly, like highly polished knives. He nodded cordially to her and stood.
Thank you for your time, Captain.
The Partheni was standing protectively by Tolemier, regarding Hevea with narrow-eyed belligerence. She didn't return the nod. On his way out, Hevea was already composing his report in his head. Parthenon involvement. Request further instructions. Idris. Colonial tradition was for grieving to be brief. The living needed to move on. It came from when the dead had outnumbered the living, and there just wasn't time for protracted mourning. And it wasn't as though the end of the war had cured death. Spacers died. They died hard, and they still died often. They were the lifeblood of the human sphere, from the crews of the huge dilapidated freighters whose timely arrival with holds of food was the difference between plenty and starvation, all the way down to the packet runners, who carried nothing but information and barely stayed out of suspension for longer than it took to download. They died when life support failed. They died crazy in the deep void. They died when decades of careful maintenance ceased to be enough to hold their aging ships together. They died on both sides of pirate actions, of hereditary conditions, in impromptu brawls in sordid brothels or orbital bars. And their friends moved on. But you couldn't move on without a ship to move you. Losing a ship was a disaster that you literally could only walk away from. Kittering had been searching for opportunities for the crew all morning, without success. No vessel would take them on as a group. Rollo was fiercely adamant that he'd take nothing less than a shareholding second, and Idris privately thought that he wouldn't want to be the captain who took Rollo on as a subordinate. At some point, Idris knew, the crew would simply part under the stress of the situation, so that they would all drift outwards and probably never meet again. He certainly wasn't going anywhere without Chris to fight for him. He felt a cold shiver at the thought that she might turn to safe work on planet as an advocate. She'd been running a long time, after all. Around that point, the spook turned up, which didn't improve anybody's mood much. And Idris had overreacted, of course. Too much stress and grief over too short a time. He'd let himself off his own personal leash, and that always left him feeling tired and sick. Probably the man really wasn't here with ulterior motives. But then Solace had arrived. He would worry later what conclusions the Mordant houseman would draw about Partheni involvement. Hugh attention was never welcome. Yet right then, he'd never been so glad to see anyone as he was to have Solace beside him. And the spook had cleared out almost immediately. Solace's proprietary air should have got on his nerves, but with Chris absent, he clung to the thought that someone was looking out for him. That's wretched, Idris. Just wretched. But he felt rubbed raw, as though every new development was salt on open wounds.
I thought you'd left. Gone back to...
Rollo made a vague gesture, presumably intended to indicate the whole institution of the Parthenon.
I've been seeing what I can do, Solace told him, as a member of your crew.
And are you? Still?
She met his bleary-eyed belligerence head-on.
Do you still have a crew?
Rollo dropped his gaze first.
I don't know, my daughter.
If you do, then I'm still on it. Until the next job, when we can negotiate all over again. And I have something to say. But where are Chris and Ollie?
Rollo glanced at Kittering, whose screens informed them that they were inbound with word. Solace nodded.
Then, let's hear what they have for us.
My ship's headed for Tarakuma,
Rollo echoed, after Chris had rattled out their news.
That figures, my children,
he sighed and said again,
Tarakuma, it's a goddamn armpit.
Explain, Solace asked, and Rollo rolled his eyes at her.
Not having to know about or go to Tarakuma is a profound incentive to back the Parthenon.
He rubbed at his face, as though trying to scrub the alcohol out of his skin.
It's a shithole, is what it is.
Back before, Chris filled in, there were plans for a big colony there. It was going to be a grand terraforming venture. Rocky planet, bad chemistry. But they had all the time and money in the world, didn't they? And what the place did have was location. 7 throughways meet at Tarakuma. Then the architects happened, and then the war. Whole lot of refugees ended up in Tarakuma, because it was so easy to reach. What didn't end up there was money or terraforming kit. People came there from everywhere. Aliens too. Gangs, warlords, cults. They got the vertical cities running. Bought atmosphere modifiers, kept out most of the bad wildlife. Even now, Hugh's got only the loosest grasp over what goes on down there.
Way I hear it, that's how they like it, Ollie put in sourly. Gives Hugh a place to bend their own laws, gives their spies a place to meet other spies, all sort of shadowy ballsack stuff.
Kittering chittered, his screens responding to a query Chris had raised. She read off the information.
There are maybe 100 major players on Tarakuma and any number of off-world cartels and syndicates who've got fingers in the pie. The Broken Harvest are some kind of criminal enterprise from out of the hegemony, Chris reported.
Wouldn't have thought their perfect paradise empire would have gangsters, Idris said mildly.
I don't pretend to understand it myself, Chris replied, but the Essiel have a strange attitude towards outlaws and crime. They hate it and openly fight lawbreakers, and yet it's also a recognised part of their system somehow. So yes, the Broken Harvest are some mob out of the hegemony, but if they're on Tarakuma, they obviously stray beyond its borders.
So why, Rollo demanded ponderously, do they want my ship?
Maybe we were just unlucky, said Ollie.
Surely they want the Amaru, not the Vulture. Plenty of people would pay to control that evidence. Either hide it or shove it up a flagpole.
Ollie eyed Solace.
You fuckers, for instance.
The Partheni met the accusation without a frown. Honestly, not our style.
Harvest'll have a sale lined up for the Amaru, or maybe they'll auction it. But the Vulture, I mean, it's a decent ship, but it's not the prize. Maybe we could even buy it back off them, cut a deal, work for the mob to secure it.
Idris looked from one to the other, seeing how Ollie's suggestion sat. Not well, but not beyond anyone's personal morality, was his conclusion. During his years with the Vulture, they'd never worked for criminals directly. But you might have only had to go one step down the chain to find dirty money. On the other hand, working for the Broken Harvest meant clasping wrists with Barney and Medvig's killers. Not something to be done lightly. The same dilemma had probably played out in Rollo's head, for he said,
"We could go there. See if they haven't already sold or scrapped her. Work passage over to Terracuma and see how things lie. And if there's a chance for revenge."
His face went hard at that thought. He could be a vengeful man. Dangerous waters, Idris knew. Am I getting cold feet? Icy cold. But he couldn't abandon his crewmates.
"Kit," said Rollo at last, "hunt down berths Terracuma ways, as passengers or crew, whatever it takes."
He looked round at them.
"Anyone wants out, then get out. No hard feelings, for I am in the mood to do some truly stupid things."
Solace coughed slightly. "Idris?" He looked at her warily, and for a long 2 seconds, she just met his gaze. Then she asked, "How long does it take to get from here to Terracuma on the throughways?" Kit crabwised over, presenting a reckoner on one arm screen and highlighting the most useful routes.
"Bear with me," Idris said, checking the displays, and then, "Can't get it down to under 3 days by any route."
"And if you were to pilot us from here yourself, off-piste?"
"Off, you mean deep void?"
He hadn't realised the Partheni had their own term.
"Somewhere between 19 and 23 ship hours,"
meaning the hours old Earth had used. Rollo grunted.
"You think we can charter something?"
He sounded dubious, and Kittering was already cautioning about expense.
"Listen," Solace told them, "I want you all to come with me right now. I want to show you something."
She stood, and after a moment Rollo did too, and then Chris. Ollie and Kit were already on their various feet. Solace looked at Idris, not a challenge so much as an entreaty. He shrugged, feeling tired and vaguely anxious about whatever the woman had in mind.
"Whatever it is, I'm not going to like it."
Solace took them towards the dock levels, a ring of small private jetties. The great and the good kept their launches and yachts here. Idris bleakly enjoyed the mortified looks they received from liveried technicians and flunkies, seeing this motley mob of spacers slouching through their pristine corridors. And then they were at a door, with two Partheni myrmidons outside, in full armour and armed with accelerators. The crew shrank back as one, fearing ambush, Kittering practically disappearing behind Rollo's legs. Solace just nodded to the soldiers, and the women stepped smartly aside with a mutual Myrmidon executor? Ollie swore faintly as the door slid open.
"What treasonous shit have we gotten ourselves into?"
"No idea," Idris lied. He was half expecting to be grabbed and bagged right here and the rest of them shot. There was just one ship in the bay. It was a segmented teardrop, half the size of the Vulture God and entirely lacking in the thrown-together look that was practically colonial aesthetic. Its surface was silvery, and some of the jutting nodules that flanked its nose were probably weapons. There was a column of Parsef characters on the side, along with its company badges. Kittering's screens helpfully translated its name as the Dark Joan.
"What's this, my child?"
Rollo asked cautiously. "Captain Rostand, I have a proposal."
"Crew to captain, or Partheni to a poor colonial?"
His moustache bristled, but his eyes kept sliding back to the Dark Joan. "I went to the embassy," she told them all, and abruptly there was a distance between Solis and the rest of them, a gap of status as much as physical space. "This is one of our packet transport ships. I've requisitioned it." They stared at her, or at least their stares were split between her and the shining perfection of the ship.
"You mean," Chris said slowly, "you said, I want this ship, and they just let you have it?"
"Borrow it," Solis agreed. Her hands were wringing at each other. Idris wondered if she realised. Maybe Partheni didn't get nervous around each other, so she'd not had his practice in hiding it. Rollo was suddenly very sober.
"My daughter," he said flatly. "The guards called you executor. What are you?"
"Executors are trained to go outside the Parthenon sphere and do what must be done."
"You're an assassin," Ollie said flatly.
"Ollie,"
Chris reproached her.
"She's what? A spy? An agent?"
"An agent," Solis confirmed. "So, when I say I need the use of a ship, I have a ship. Which, here, means you have a ship. If you want it. Now Idris can get to Tarakuma ahead of the Vulture, so you can get your ship back."
There was a long silence in response to that. It was Rollo who put all their feelings into words.
"And why would you do such a thing, honoured executor?"
Solis licked her lips. She looked a decade younger than the captain, shorter, slighter of build. Idris had to remind himself that she was even older than he was and could likely kill the lot of them with her bare hands. "Because it's in the interests of my government that I learn everything I can about the Amaru. Getting to Tarakuma, and fast, is the first step in doing that." She swallowed. "And because I think you're good people." Ollie made a disgusted noise.
"Forgive me for saying this, my friend," Rollo said,
with that polite distance he put between his crew and others,
"but that does not sound very Partheni to me."
Solis's brow furrowed. "What's the Parthenon, Captain?" She seemed to have reluctantly accepted that distance. "How did we come about? Do you know?"
"A bunch of clever women decided that they would go grow a whole load of other women in test tubes because they hated men," Ollie said,
going from a standing start to staggeringly undiplomatic in record time. "Wasn't that it?" Rollo shot her a look, but Solis held up a hand. "That's how the nativists tell it. Maybe that's how they tell it all over the colonies," she shrugged. "The Parthenon was founded because of good people. Parsifer and her fellows looked at the way Earth had gone and saw inequality, exploitation, divisions, hatred and ignorance. They wanted to start again and do better. And if you're boosting your population through VAT parthenogenesis, it's easier just to work with the female line." Idris reckoned that was both a simplified and sanitized explanation, but perhaps it was what Solis believed. Ollie scowled, but Rollo glared at her.
"One last thing before we clasp arms on any deal, my friend. Why did you pretend to join my crew?"
For a fraction of a second, Idris caught real hurt on Solis's face before she covered it with her usual martial impassivity. "I did join your crew, Captain. I worked my passage. But you're right. I had another motive too. She glanced at Idris, probably wondering if he was going to spill the beans. He wouldn't, he decided. She pressed on anyway, laying it all bare. I was sent to make an offer to your pilot, on behalf of the Parthenon. An offer I still intend to make, when I can get him to take his fingers out of his ears for long enough. No doubt he'll say no, and that will be my duty done. Now the Amaru is out there too, and that changes things. I'm using my discretion right now, doing what I think is best while I wait for orders to reach me. But I also want you to get your ship back, because that is fair and just. Hence this. A flip of the hand towards the Dark Joan. Take it or leave it, Captain. I'm going anyway. I won't say I don't care either way, but it's your choice. Rollo looked at his crew. Kittering was displaying 44%, which suggested he was ambivalent in the extreme, and Ollie was looking outright angry. Chris was nodding, though, and Idris found himself agreeing. Left with the casting vote, Rollo let out a deep breath.
Then, my friend, we would be delighted to get our asses over to Tarakuma as fast as Idris can plot the course there. Assuming our asses will even fit in that pint pot thing of yours.
Idris felt a rush of excitement. It would be grand to steal a march on the hijackers. But he was mostly thinking that he'd never in all his days flown a ship as elegant as the Dark Joan.